I'm going to call the House State Affairs Committee to order at 2:04 p.m. on Wednesday, December 2nd. Representative Story is on the line. We're having some technical issues with the display here, so if members are online and I'm slow in recognizing you, I apologize for that in advance. Today's hearing is about workplace safety and returning to work safely, and we have had previous hearings looking at policy, but this is more of an informational hearing for building owners and managers. And this hearing really was proposed by some folks in the industry. And I appreciate the American Society of Interior Designers with professionals from a bunch of different companies for bringing their expertise and providing some ideas about ways to reconfigure workplaces and help keep people safe when people don't have a choice except to be at work in person. Obviously, we have a hunker down order from the municipality, which I think wisely tries to limit the number of people who are indoors sharing air. But, of course, in some workplaces, you have to be inside together. And the purpose of today's hearing is to provide information for building owners and managers about how to do that as safely as possible. So with that, I hope the members will jump in any kind of questions. And with that, I want to turn to Kelsey Davidson, a member of the American Society of Interior Designers and a principal at SALT. Ms. Davidson, would you like to start this hearing?
Yes. Thank you so much, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for inviting us. I did have AK Live on my screen to monitor where you guys are in the presentation, but since that's having technical difficulties, I assume you're on slide one. We have been invited to present this panel discussion for a safe return to public spaces in the time of COVID. We'll be hearing from a few other committee members today as we get into the content of the presentation, as well as a local representative of ASHRAE, which is the American Society of Heating, Refrigerating, and Air Conditioning Engineers. The panelists will introduce themselves shortly, but we'd like to begin the presentation today with a preface. Service providers, businesses, and institutions face the necessity of creating COVID-responsive workplaces and public buildings, addressing an array of infection control safety measures. These impact utilization and planning, building sustainability and wellness, individual comfort and safety, cleanliness and disinfection, mitigating touchpoint contamination, and promotion of operational and procedural interventions. Commercial interior design is rooted in the concept of evidence-based design, especially applicable as science evolves around the novel coronavirus. To address infection mitigation in the design and outfitting of workplace environments is based on best practices learned through current science as it continues to evolve. Although we can't eliminate the risk in the workplace entirely, we can implement flexible approaches and solutions that allow us to feel safe and comfortable in the places we work, learn, live, heal, and recreate.
Next slide, please. Ms. Davidson, if you could pause for just 1 second, I apologize. I should have mentioned at the beginning, testifiers, please speak into the phone and don't use the hands-free function. And I also wanted to recognize Representatives Craig Tompkins and Representative Merrick Joynes. Sorry for the interruption, and please proceed.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I just switched from headphones. Can you hear me better?
That sounds a little better, yep. It was just a little
dark. Okay, thank you. Don't want that. Thank you so much. I'm not sure if we're on slide two, but if we could move to slide two, that would be great. In the last 9 months of this COVID environment that we're all dealing with, we've encountered many questions related to the topic of how to safely return or reopen public buildings. And we've been addressing the following questions, or we plan to address the following questions in our presentation today. I'll just read through these quickly. One is, how do we determine if our workplace is ready for reoccupancy? Two, if our building owners won't replace or update our air system, how might we mitigate airborne infection within our individual suite? Three, do portable air purifiers disinfect the air, and could we use multiples around the office?
4, how can we mitigate touchpoint contamination in our school? 5, I think our staff is nervous about returning to the office building. How can we make sure it's safe and help them feel okay? 6, what modifications can be implemented with very limited funds? 7, how do these solutions vary for schools, prisons, hotels, or restaurants? 8, what is HVAC and how can it help me get back to work? And 9, why is the finish on our waiting area furniture suddenly failing? So these questions will be addressed by our panel of experts, which will now introduce themselves if we progress to the next slide. Dana Nunn will speak first.
Thank you, Kelsey. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, good afternoon. I'm Dana Nunn. I'm a commercial interior designer and a project manager based in Anchorage. In the 17 years I've worked in Alaska, my projects have focused on safety, accessible and universal design, sustainability, design for wellness, and all of this founded on an integrative evidence-based design process. Most recently, I've participated in the International WELL Building Institute's task force studying the role buildings can play in reducing the health burden of COVID-19 and other respiratory infections. I lead a team of 6 interior designers as the interior design director for Bettisworth North. Mary?
Thank you, Dana. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Mary Knopp, and I am a WSU graduate with over 35 years of commercial design experience in Alaska. I have served as president of the Alaska chapter of ASID and on the ASID National Board of Directors. My focus is in creating safe, healthy, and sustainable interior environments for education, office, hospitality, healthcare, and public institutional buildings. I'm a principal with ECI, an architectural and planning and interiors firm in Anchorage. Greg, you're next.
Thank you. So my name is Craig Rohrer, and I am a specialist in mechanical air systems and products. I have served with the Alaska Board of Directors for ASHRAE the past 6 years, working towards educating our Alaskan members on topics that are relevant to our region and our climate. I've earned a degree in mechanical engineering, and I'm very passionate about our energy systems and cost-effective ways to implement them to improve, and specifically most recently, improving air filtration and purification to help us mitigate this virus pandemic that we are in. I'm currently an account manager with Train here in the Anchorage area. Thank you. Next slide, please.
Thank you, Craig. This is Kelsey again. Presentation outline for today will cover 4 topics and then open up space at the end of the presentation for questions and discussion. The 4 topics will start with workplace screening, circulation, space planning, and partitions. Dana will cover that topic. Next, we'll look at sustainable, healthy buildings and the human factor covered by Mary. Third, we'll look at cleaning, sanitizing, disinfecting, and operational interventions with Dana. And then fourth, we'll review mechanical systems and air filtration with Craig. All right, so with that, I'll hand it over to Dana to dive into our first topic. Next slide, please.
Thanks, Kelsey. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I work with a range of Alaskan clients, including agencies, school districts, healthcare organizations, recreation, retail, and hospitality businesses, and building owners. In all cases, our clients have been looking for a silver bullet in the effort to overcome COVID and return to normal. And unfortunately, I think we all realize there isn't one at this point. A multi-pronged approach that addresses human behavior, changes in our built environments, and operational adjustments is necessary for greatest impact in this pandemic. We continue to encourage a longer view, investment in improvements for long-term resilience, and solutions that have value for our current situation and beyond. And when implementing COVID-specific solutions, we're encouraging our clients to adopt flexible strategies so that they aren't stuck with an expensive something that cannot be easily removed, expanded, or modified as new evidence comes to light, informing more specific solutions. Businesses and organizations have many different requirements to meet in order to maintain operations through COVID, and those requirements seem to always be changing. State and local mandates add complexity to our collective pandemic response, and designers continue to follow those developments closely so we can advise clients of their responsibilities and options to meet them within their spaces. Ultimately, our national and local public health experts are our first points of reference for information about the disease and how best to mitigate transmission. We're also keeping a close eye on developments in allied sciences to better understand the interrelation of the built environment and disease transmission. A lot has been learned in healthcare environments over the years, and we're starting to see studies focused on other building types now that we better understand the dynamics of the disease. So look for more information in the near future. It's important to remember that OSHA requirements for workplace safety still apply, and in some cases have implications where perhaps they didn't before, since many employees are now handling cleaning and disinfection duties or encountering other new hazards. Accessibility requirements in accordance with the ADA still applies as well, so businesses must continue to provide reasonable accommodation where new operations and distancing protocols may impede access. As businesses began to implement their COVID response plans, screening occupants at building and suite entry points has become the norm. Smaller organizations are handling screening with handheld thermometers and a logbook to support contact tracing. Others have deployed iPads with specific apps to conduct more discrete screening. And more recently, I've been working with clients these last few months that are implementing automated screening systems at their entry points, using thermal cameras with signals or displays to confirm or discreetly discourage entry. The available systems range widely, from fancy cameras integrated into networks and security systems, or simpler localized app-based systems. The more complicated systems seem much better suited to larger organizations with a very high volume of employees and guests coming to their space, and with a grander entry, so that you can actually accommodate the space required for a new screening sequence. Our cold temperatures more recently have also been impacting the efficacy of some of the fancier systems, which really tends to lead us to encourage our clients to stick with the iPads and things like that for right now. We've been working with many clients to modify circulation through buildings and suites, establishing separate entry and exit points, implementing one-way traffic patterns, and widening circulation paths wherever possible, all of this to minimize overlap of the 6-foot bubble. Exiting, access to restrooms and elevators and stairs, and security concerns all come into play when we're studying and developing these strategies. Modified circulation should not impede life safety features within our buildings. And we find that altered circulation plans are most successful with clear signage that indicates how to proceed and then reinforces that you're going the right way. Some businesses have adopted operational solutions to help manage occupant load and circulation. For example, our healthcare clients are limiting access to their waiting rooms in order to stagger patients and provide enough time for cleaning and disinfection between encounters. Recently, the new DMV location in Anchorage implemented an app-based solution to limit and direct patron traffic within the facility.
Ms. Thompson, if you could just pause for 1 second. Sorry, sure. Representative Thompson. Joint thanks, Representative Thompson, Grace Tompkins, Merrick, and Story. I think I've recognized everyone who's online. Sorry for the interruption, and please proceed.
Very good. Thank you. So hopefully we're on slide 6 now. One of the first things we did for our own business was to conduct an analysis of our office and develop plans for reducing occupant density, implementing protocols for sharing spaces and amenities, and identifying locations for hygiene and cleaning stations. And we've since completed similar studies for many of our clients throughout the state, helping them understand and plan how they might bring their workforce back to the office, whether in full or in some sort of modified shift situation. In some cases, we've created plans for temporary expanded offices to support larger teams or businesses with more client and patron traffic, or we've helped to rearrange offices to provide a greater variety of workstation types to accommodate the drop-ins for folks that are primarily working remotely but may need to come into the office occasionally. In all of these cases, universal masking combined with distancing inside our businesses and public facilities are imperative, no matter how spacious your building or suite may be. And it's important to develop and enforce guidelines for the use of shared spaces, like print areas, break rooms, and meeting spaces, and to communicate expectations for masking or other practices in private offices versus open work areas. If leadership doesn't consistently demonstrate compliance with the new plans, it's quite unlikely your employees or your customers will either. A well-designed hybrid plan that provides choice in the settings individuals and groups need to work and collaborate is something the design community has discussed for years, but many businesses and agencies have been slow to adopt a more flexible plan. And this pandemic will probably change that situation quite a bit. Remote working flat out eliminates the potential for transmission between employees, and we see the virtual workplace remaining a prominent aspect of workplace design going forward. However, we recognize that it's critical in some situations and for some businesses that people come together in person for collaboration and improved productivity. And to that end, the flexible hybrid plan will support that dual modality. Workstation panels and partitions are definitely part of the discussion, though there's mixed reviews on how much separation is actually helpful versus a hindrance to safety in the facility or to contributing to employee complacency in some of the infection control protocols. What's interesting from a furniture and office design standpoint is evidence emerging from MIT's Fluid Dynamics of Disease Transmission Laboratory, which is beginning to reveal the interrelation of ventilation systems, furniture design and layout, and disease transmission. This is emerging, as I mentioned, and so we're watching this line of research quite closely because we want to work together with allied disciplines to create healthier interior environments without degrading the desired effects of building systems improvements. Healthy return to work. Yes, sir.
So early on in the pandemic, you know, we've heard this fairly simplistic, maintain 6-foot distance. Obviously, we should always seek to maintain 6 feet of distance. But as more evidence is accumulated, and we've heard in this committee from some of the experts who have informed WHO guidelines that actually the virus can spread at distances greater than 6 feet, particularly indoors where you have inadequate ventilation. How have design recommendations evolved in response to that emerging science about aerosolized transmission of the virus?
Well, so some of the interior design or furniture and space design implications are emerging, as I mentioned, the research that's coming out of MIT right now. Ultimately, everyone should have a mask on, and that helps to keep things within a smaller bubble because it's capturing the larger droplets and capturing at least some of what's being aerosolized when you speak. Beyond that, some level of partition is still something that we're encouraging clients, but I tend to encourage a slightly lower partition. People kind of want to go all the way up because we want to encapsulate people. And what's coming out of the new research is that in some situations, depending on the geometry and the volume of your space and what your ventilation system may be, that might actually be creating eddies in the air system, so pockets of stagnating air where you could potentially have building viral loads. And so the results of that research are not definitive yet, but it's looking like we want lower partitions that, again, help to block the larger particles and masking. And then in a little bit, Craig can speak specifically to all the different ways we can then handle those smaller aerosolized particles that are transmitted and moving around the space. Any other questions right now?
No, thank you.
Okay, thanks. I think we're ready to transition to Mary now and to slide 7, please.
Thank you, Dana. So the Centers for Disease Control define indoor environmental quality as the building's environment in relation to the health and well-being of those who occupy space within it. So in considering returning to the workplace, we need to account for the human factor. And Dana mentioned a little bit about this. There's been a major shift in work-life balance as well as opportunities to rethink the office environment. Employers need to have protocols and policies in place to help mitigate the stress, physical, and mental safety concerns of returning to the workplace. Employees who see that their employers care and are doing everything they can to provide a safe environment will experience much less anxiety. Healthy buildings contribute to the health of the occupants, and they tend to include simplified... Oh, my God. Oh.
Yes, we can still hear you. Just had momentary feedback, which seems to have gone away.
Okay, thank you. So healthy buildings do contribute to the health of the occupants, and they tend to include simplified finishes, clean spaces, clear of clutter. Life stages also are a factor to take into consideration in determining how we wish to return to work. Younger employees do need more structure and mentorship, while seasoned staff may prefer to work individually. With reduced occupancy, scheduling to benefit all stages is needed by employers. We need to be cognizant about how our interiors impact indoor air quality as well. By selecting materials and furnishings that support a healthy environment, materials and products can impact mental health as well as physical health. We spend approximately 90% of our time inside, and by limiting volatile organic compounds, caustic chemicals, and plastics, we improve the air that we breathe. The materials we select assist in mitigating dust, mold, and mildew habitats. And new materials are being developed all the time. Currently, there is one that is inherently antimicrobial using silver nanoparticles. And one such product that is coming out from that is a ceramic tile for restroom, retail, and healthcare use for walls and floors. That way that these silver particles are encapsulated so that they are safer. Thermal and acoustical comfort is impacted by furniture layout and configurations, which can affect air circulation, as Dana was mentioning, in relation to air supply and return diffusers, as well as operable windows. In open offices especially, we need to create private, quiet, respite zones, which Dana also talked about, the having various work environments within one space, to allow employees to take a break or to complete focused work. There are many options to introduce acoustical materials, from lighting to ceilings and wall finishes and furniture finishes. Many of these products are made from recycled water bottles and are easily disinfected. White or pink noise systems also are much more readily available and easier to install than they used to be for acoustical comfort. As far back as 1991, studies have affirmed the power of nature to reduce anxiety. Natural light, views, and the use of organic forms, as well as the addition of biophilic design patterns from nature, contribute to comfortable, healthy interiors. In addition to airflow, modifications to space configurations can provide better views to extend daylight further into a space. And window treatments are also available that let through the light and views while reducing glare. And then lastly, I wanted to introduce a couple green building programs to you if you are not familiar with them. In Alaska, our systems are naturally designed for energy efficiency due to our climate, but these programs provide shared knowledge for further efficiencies and design initiatives. The first one is LEED, which is the Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design, and that certifies buildings' sustainability at various levels from basic to platinum. The second is the International Living Future Institute, or ILFI, and they offer the Living Building Challenge, which focuses on the design of net zero buildings, which are those that produce as much or more energy than they use, and balance water. And finally, well building design goes beyond the other two in focusing on both the physical and mental health. They cover exposure to light, movement, thermal comfort, sound, materials, and an emphasis on mind and community. So moving forward, interior designers will be working with our clients to continue improving and adjusting interior solutions to provide the best possible safe and healthy interior environments using current best practices. So the next slide goes back to Dana.
Thank you, Mary. I believe we're on 8, and I'll just add on to something Mary mentioned about the systems that are available. The International Well Building Institute just recently released a health and safety rating system, and we're not keen on checklists in Alaska, but it still serves as a really great guide for how to build resilience within your organization, your facility, and your community. And it speaks to some of the tenets of the well-building standard, but it also speaks to some of the things that the task force learned through our research on COVID-19 and how the built environment can help impede transmission. So moving on then, we've learned, of course, over the last many months that COVID-19 is transmitted primarily person-to-person, shared through droplets and aerosols. However, touchpoint contamination, That's hands or objects touching something and then touching something else and spreading it around, is still a factor that we can manage with behavioral changes, effective cleaning protocols, and hands-free solutions. Frequent and proper hand hygiene is highly effective in reducing the spread of COVID-19. The nature of this virus means that basic soap and water, doesn't even have to be antibacterial soap, are incredibly effective at degrading the virus's lipid encapsulation, essentially destroying the virus altogether. Hand sanitizer with a high alcohol content, we've learned, is still effective. It will disable the virus, but it does not destroy it, making sanitizer a good stand-in, but not the go-to for ideal hand hygiene. Thoughtful planning of your workspaces and businesses can make it easier for people to practice the habit. And let's face it, I think we all know we should all be washing our hands more often. Consider how many and where to place hand washing amenities, evaluating need, proximity, ease of access, and alternatives when soap and water washing are not feasible. And really take into account the issues of supply and upkeep. An initial step in minimizing touchpoint contamination is to reduce the frequency of person-to-person contact and contact with high-touch surfaces. Where clients' facility maintenance budgets allow, we're seeing hands-free devices and technology being implemented, whether it's automated faucets and dispensers or automated doors, and low-tech solutions like foot or wrist pulls on restroom doors. Proper cleaning and disinfection are another way of mitigating touchpoint contamination. It's important to understand the difference between cleaning and disinfecting so that effective procedures are developed and deployed. Cleaning reduces the number of germs, dirt, and impurities on a surface. Disinfecting kills the germs on the surface. And the CDC points out that cleaning is necessary before disinfection is even possible. The dual action of cleaning and disinfecting further lowers the risk of spreading infection. At the outset of the pandemic, a direct and very harsh approach to disinfection was employed across the board. Many businesses and individuals rapidly adopt cleaning and disinfection chemistries borrowed from the healthcare industry, but they paid no mind to the appropriate use of those products to render the effort effective. Without observing the dwell time, which is the time that the material or the product is allowed to work on a surface, as recommended by the manufacturer, effective disinfection isn't even happening. And so commonly people would wipe down a counter and walk away, and they were cleaning the surface. But if the surface wasn't left glistening wet with the product that they were using for the recommended dwell time, they did not disinfect anything. Some products are more rapidly effective than others, a result of the varied chemistries and the mechanics of how they attack the virus. For instance, I think we're all familiar with wipe products like Clorox or Kirkland wipes, and most of those don't use bleach. They actually employ a diluted quaternary ammonium compound that requires 4 to 5 minutes of dwell time. In Alaska's dry climate, where one wipe dries out really, really quickly, one wipe simply will not accomplish the task of disinfecting a counter or other surface. Other products, like Lysol Formula 409, are fantastic, for example, leverage different chemistries in combination with surfactants and degreasing agents. And so those can disinfect a surface in as little as 30 seconds. It's important to note that not all disinfectants are effective against all or even specific viruses. So in the case of our pandemic, it's a good idea to verify the effectiveness of the product you prefer to use. And the EPA's List N is the best resource to confirm both that it's effective and what the dwell time is to actually achieve disinfection. And both of those should be considered when you're developing your cleaning plans, accounting for who will do the task, how long they have to devote to that task, and how critical it is that the various surfaces in your spaces are properly disinfected. And if you haven't already, Mary mentioned the other uncluttered surface policy, but now is a great time to implement that policy. Without it, your custodial staff have a really difficult time working through your space, thoroughly cleaning and disinfecting communal areas and workstations regularly, especially if they've been directed not to touch things on someone's desk, for instance. That means that that surface probably isn't getting disinfected at all by your custodial staff. While the use of stronger cleaning and disinfecting products has long been a consideration in healthcare design, as designers were considering those products when we're specifying materials in all settings, whether it's workplace, schools, corrections facilities that I'm working on right now, cleaning and disinfection protocols and products have a significant impact on the durability and the life of your interior finished materials and furnishings, especially porous products like wood finishes, plastics, leather, and upholsteries. If you choose to use fogging devices like we're seeing in some industries, which often use bleach or hydrogen peroxide disinfectant, you need to know that your interior finishes and upholsteries can withstand those products without developing bleach spots. And with those same devices, if you have open shelving, say in a break area, you might need to reconsider that. Otherwise, those cleaning products can come to rest on your coffee cups and glassware and pose a risk of ingestion. UVC light is another technology that healthcare uses for disinfection, and we're seeing that used more frequently in schools, transportation, hospitality, and even in public restrooms. It can be very effective with the right dosage, but it also can rapidly degrade and fade interior surfaces like plastic laminate cabinetry, flooring, paint, upholsteries, artwork, or even students' outerwear stored in classroom cubbies. Ultimately, our best strategy in combating COVID-19 and building community resilience is to adopt an integrated approach to planning and design. So engaging your stakeholders, both internally and externally, becomes really critical. Be mindful to include those that might not normally be part of your higher-level conversations, your custodial and environmental services staff, facility maintenance, and the various team leaders that will be expected to implement your plans. On the design side, we absolutely believe it's just as important to have your architects or your designers as it is to have your engineering consultants. That well-coordinated solution, no matter the complexity, will be more successful if the right hand and the left hand are working in concert instead of against each other. Communicate often. Don't just tell people what you're doing, but also show them, especially since so many of the strategies that are going to be employed are invisible. I mean, people see shields, people see stickers on the wall, but they don't necessarily know what you're doing with your HVAC system or with your cleaning protocols. So tell them about it and tell them frequently. That will certainly contribute to their comfort level and decrease anxiety. And then walk the talk. Demonstrate your commitment to your plans by doing them yourselves, providing your employees with proper training, and within your business or your organization, enforcing your new protocols. So with an integrated approach in mind, Craig will share more about the building systems and solutions that impact our public facilities.
All right. Thank you, Dana. We could be on slide 9. So my name is Craig, and I'll be covering the mechanical ventilation systems and filtration for viral mitigation strategies. The CDC and the WHO have established guidelines and safe practices of airborne viral mitigation. And with ASHRAE, we have helped to break those down into three main categories: close contact or large droplet, which is the most common transmission; airborne transmission, which is less common but still a high frequency; and then surface or fomite, as it's called, a transmission, which is the least common. I'll also be covering how four key areas of our indoor air quality: dilution, which is increasing ventilation with our outdoor air; exhausting, keeping exhaust fans in a building operating; contain, and this is specific to containing the humidity in our space to help reduce viral propagation; and cleaning, which is safely using all air cleaning technology we have at our disposal. So we have multiple mitigation technologies that we can implement, and those are, again, broken down into three simple categories: good, better, and best. And I will go through each one of those in the following slides. So next slide, please. On slide 10 here. So they've got it broken down into three categories, right? We've got direct. I don't think we need to highlight too much on this. Everyone understands the wearing the mask, maintaining the 6 feet. This is a close contact. I think Dana highlighted this pretty effectively. The fomite, which is the direct contact, washing your hands, hand sanitizer, not touching your face, giving it an opportunity. I don't think I need to highlight any more on that. Aerosol, that is the air in our spaces, in our restaurants, in our retail spaces. That is where I'm going to spend some more time and focus on what we can do to help clean and sterilize that space. So next slide, please. Slide 11. So there's four ways that we can control our indoor air quality. So we have dilution, which is increasing ventilation with more outdoor air. The key here is to maximize the outdoor air that we have as much as possible within the equipment, heating, and cooling limits that we have available. Disabling CO2. Some systems change the amount of outside air we bring in based on how many people are in the facility. Well, the idea is now to disable that and allow it to run at a maximum to help create more air turnover and dilute any potential viral compounds that may be in the airspace. Leaving your systems running 24/7, this prevents air from being stagnant, from falling out of suspension in your air systems. It keeps it moving through the air and keeps it flushing. Another option is adding pre and post purge, which is effectively running your system at 100% outside air if possible, and flushing your building prior to occupancy in the early morning hours. This helps to really flush the building out and get all indoor air contaminants out as best as possible. Go back to an occupied mode during when people are present, and then after the end of the day, we do the post, which is, again, it's been building up all day with people being in the space. We do a post purge, and we flush the building out again to try and keep that out and minimize that.
Mr. Rohr, if I could jump in,
yes.
What's the appropriate number of times, if there is an appropriate number of times, to replace the air in a room or in a structure per hour? I think I've heard different things in the media about what building owners should strive for. Do you have recommendations on that?
Yeah, so typical is your design, most engineers are designing around 3 air changes per hour. For doing the flushing, this pre and post flush, what they're recommending is pushing that all the way to 6. So you're really pushing the boundaries of what your system may be able to do. If it can't do 6, the recommendation is do as much as you can, because that'll help stir up any dust particles or any viral particles that may be suspended in the air and help to flush them out of the facility.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So exhausting, so this is keeping your exhausts running, specifically bathroom exhausts. They tend to collect more dirty air than other places in buildings, so maintaining it and running those 24/7 and not turning them off at night, not having them actuate on and off with a light switch on the wall, just basically hardwiring them to run continuously. Containing, so this is containing our indoor air humidity. There's been multiple studies that have shown that viruses and bacteria propagate and spread faster below 40% humidity and above 60% humidity. So the goal is to keep the humidity in our space in that narrow range of 40 to 60% to reduce the ability for the viruses and other compounds to propagate and replicate. It can be done by adding in-space humidifiers, or if it's possible, add it to a whole building humidity system and control it in that way. I know that's very important here in the winter because it's very typical of our indoor offices to be downwards of 25-30% humidity, which the virus now has an even higher ability to propagate and replicate. So we want to try and increase that humidity back up, which is always a challenge, especially when we're running lots of outside air, which is cold and dry, and we're exhausting lots of air. We're exhausting our humidity. So there's a obvious balance here that we need to work towards and work with our building engineers and facility managers how to work through.
Mr. Rohr, if I can jump in with a kind of practical question here. So
yes,
for the average building occupant who's thinking, gosh, should I add a portable humidifier in this office, is it fair to say that, you know, take your average office building in Anchorage, built in the 80s or 90s, that you're never going to get above 60% relative humidity in the winter, you know, even if you have a portable humidifier in your office? Is that a reasonable assumption to make?
I think that's a reasonable assumption to make. Yeah, most of ARFA buildings, from what I've experienced, are fairly leaky. My office that I work in, it's relatively leaky, and getting our humidity, even in the summertime, above 50% is fairly rare. So in the wintertime, I'm shocking myself consistently. So adding a humidifier into a space, you'd have to look at it and study it and just make sure the amount of moisture put in the space doesn't cause condensation or other high humidity issues. But as a maybe a blanket statement, it would be safe to say in general that adding humidification is not going to be harmful to general building envelopes.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So the last area of indoor air quality is cleaning. And so that's involving upgrading your filtration, adding mechanical cleaning systems, injecting air sterilization into your airstreams, UV lights, and I will cover those properties in the next couple of slides. So if we can go to the next slide, slide 12. So cleaning the air, it's kind of been broken down into the three categories I said earlier, good, better, and best. We'll start with good. What are the simple things we can do? What we can do is we can add filters if we have none. So filters are rated in what's called MERV, minimum efficiency reporting values. It ranges from 1 all the way up to, I believe, 16 is the highest typical rated. MERV 8 is considered the standard in office and retail spaces. It is considered a code minimum. Your home might have a MERV 3 or MERV 5 filter if you have a furnace. So as a minimum, they recommend get yourself to a MERV 8, change your filters, increase your frequency at which you're changing out your filters. That's a bare minimum that we should be operating at. Another option is called electrostatic filters. This is using electricity to charge a filter. This is no different than you get static cling on your clothes and, you know, lint sticks to the piece of clothing. It's the same principle. We're using electricity to charge the filter to attract particles to stick to it. This allows us to use a lower rated MERV filter to collect more particles than would typically be rated based on that MERV rating. So a MERV 8 filter could act like a MERV 10 filter. It collects more particles. Another option is doing surface coatings. This could be in the form of a spray type, but for the most part, it's usually intended as a mechanical property. So this requires probably an extensive input. This is like titanium dioxide or silver compounds being applied to a surface that have natural antimicrobial properties, just to reject or kill or inactivate virus or bacterial compounds.
Mr. Rohrer, I apologize for interrupting again, but I'm wondering, could LIS staff possibly try adjusting the lights so that maybe the screen would be more easily visible for online participants or for members who are watching online? Thank you, and for members participating, feel free to give feedback if that is looking better. Thanks, and please proceed, Mr. Rohrer.
Thank you. All right, next slide, please. We should be on slide 13. So a study back in 2013 was done on the influenza A virus with MERV filters. It was tested at various different ratings. The point of this slide is to help visualize how the different MERV values increase the efficiency of capturing particles in the airstream. So MERV 8, that's code standard. That's what's probably in everyone's office buildings as a default. It's capturing 11% of the flu virus that were tested through the filter. By jumping up to MERV 13, which is now a current recommendation by ASHRAE, you're increasing that to 46% capture rate. So that's a huge jump up for not a huge increase. A typical cost, you see like a MERV 8 filter, MERV 13 filter is usually 2 to 3 times the cost is typical in the industry. If we jump up again to say MERV 15 filter, it's about double the cost from a MERV 13 filter, but now you've increased yourself to 71% capture. Now, not always increasing your filter is it possible. You'd have to look at your building and see, because as you are increasing the value of your filter, you're also increasing the air pressure against that filter, which correlates to more fan energy for your air system. And it may not be possible to do that. So on a case-by-case basis, you'd have to look and see whether doing this process is implementable. Now, HEPA was not tested as part of this particular study for the express reason that the DOE defines a HEPA filter as a 99.97% efficient filter. So it is capturing 99.97% of all particles that are filtering through it. So take that. They had an estimated 15,000 flu virons, and we're reducing that by 99.97%. So that's what I will laymanly call the gold standard of filtration systems. Not always implementable and practical in a office or a retail type application. Next slide, please. So slide 14 here. This is covering the next category, the better category. So this is jumping up in MERV filters. So we're jumping through MERV 9 through 16, which that MERV 13 filter, which is a common filter, it fits into that category. This little graph, what it's showing you is ASHRAE tests 0.3 to 10 micrometer particulate size for filters. So what you're seeing is that red bar in the center, that is the 0.3. You can see that's one of the more difficult points at which to capture a particle, and that's why we test down to that level. You can see that just as you increase, you're capturing more. You know, all up to a MERV 16 filter, you're capturing upwards almost of 75% at that 0.3 range of a particulate size. Next option is
I have a question.
Yeah.
So when you're looking at kind of your standard ventilation system, my suspicion is most buildings in Anchorage probably have MERV 8. Is replacing those with HEPA filters an option, or is HEPA more of a portable filter option for maybe a building where the occupants don't control the HVAC system and can't go to a MERV 13 for whatever reason?
They can be done both as a building-wide system or as portable. They make portable air cleaners that you just plug into a wall, has a HEPA filter, and it just recirculates the air inside your space. They also could do it as a retrofit. Doing it as a retrofit, say you take your MERV 8 filters and you want to replace it with a higher HEPA-type filter, you would have to do a real quick study with an engineer and a building manager to determine whether it's feasible, because as a general rule, a HEPA filter is going to have 4 to 5 times the pressure drop when dirty than a MERV 8 filter. So it's a significant increase in energy, fan energy, and it may not be possible to implement that that filtration increase.
Got it. One more question, just a practical question for the office worker who's reporting to work in person. Maybe their building doesn't have MERV 13 or higher filters. How often do they need to be changing the filter on their portable HEPA filter if they're able to have one in their office?
That depends. Most HEPA filters are designed for about a 6-month life. So you would have to really look at the manufacturer of the specific piece of equipment and determine. HEPA filters in, say, like a hospital facility, they're going to be replacing on a 3 to 6 month cycle. They're replacing those HEPA filters. They're doing the pre-filters, you know, like a MERV 13 that's protecting the HEPA filter. They're replacing those usually on a at most 3 month cycle. So you can stretch out your HEPA filters, which are expensive, if you have a pre-filter upstream that you replace frequently. That way you're not loading up and clogging your more expensive your HEPA filters.
Got it. Thank you.
So next item is the ultraviolet germicidal irradiation. So this is just using the UV bulbs in the band, the C band, to irradiate. We all know UV light is damaging to carbon-based life forms, ourselves included. So viruses are no exception to this. They are quite susceptible as well. There are pluses and minuses to implementing UV in an air handling system when the air is moving through rather quickly. Dana mentioned the word earlier, dwell time. Yes, there is a dwell time required for a virus to be in close contact with UV photons to be inactivated or killed. So their effectiveness in an airstream is less effective than if you were to have a portable system that you set up in a room. So you had a conference room that had a high occupancy for a short period of time and you wanted to sterilize it. Great. Take your portable UV system, put it inside the room, turn it on, let it run. It'll hit all of those surfaces and as well as what's in the air and help to inactivate any viruses that may be in the space. So it's a you have to be specific about what type of system you're using to see whether it's a feasible or useful implementation. All right, next slide, please. Another option here is hydrogen peroxide generators. So what these do is they are introducing a gas phase of hydrogen peroxide into an airstream. You would mount these inside your air handling rooftop type systems, and it distributes low concentration of hydrogen peroxide into the airstream and into the public spaces. If you've ever been to a dentist, you've gotten a hydrogen peroxide rinse with your mouth. It's an effective way to kill viruses, and it's done in such a way that they react with the viruses and basically kill them on the spot. So very effective, can be implemented in pretty much any air distribution system. Another system that does in the similar category is bipolar ionization and ozone generators. I know ozone has a little bit of a negative stigma to it, and that is because it does react with carbon-based life forms, ourselves included, and can be damaging to our skin, to our lungs. So implementing bipolar ionization that creates positive and negative ions, it's not recommended to do those in high concentration in populated areas. It is more recommended that these be used as a pre- or post-occupancy type situation. A locker room is a great place to use them. If you have a high occupancy in there, you have it turned down when people are in there. When everyone leaves the room, you crank it up and you just pump it full of the ions to help break down and inactivate all the virus, bacteria, and other odors that may be in the space. Currently, there is not a significant amount of science-based data to show that ozone or bipolar ionization generators are effective. There's a lot of anecdotal or manufacturer-supported data. So ASHRAE's stance on this is that it's not a endorsed or supported technology to use, but it does have effectiveness and it has have anecdotal data behind it. So work with an engineer to determine whether it's a good fit for the facility you have in mind. Next slide, please. We have slide 16. So this is the best category. So stated several times, HEPA filters, this is the gold standard in air filtration. Hard to implement because they're costly, have a large air pressure drop. You may not be able to use them with your air system because your fan moving the air may not have the horsepower available to work with them. But they are the most effective at capturing all the way down to that 0.3 micron rating. So if you can implement it, it's a great way to go, but again, not always practical or feasible. Next option is photocatalytic oxidization. Well, this is working with UV lights close contact to a titanium dioxide surface. And what the UV photons do is they react with titanium dioxide to create hydroxyl radicals. Now, these hydroxyl radicals have a very short half-life, about a tenth of a second before they themselves react or break down. So there's very little danger of them entering into the airspace, into the occupied space, and having them react with your lungs or your skin or other surfaces that you would not want them to. What they do is they react very quickly with any carbon-based compounds, viruses, bacteria, mold, spores, and they reduce them to CO2 and H2O. Both are fairly innocuous in low concentrations to our airspace, and there's plenty of them in our airspace already. So this is a great technology to implement in a space. The feasibility, again, it's a large expense, and it may not always be practical to implement something of this nature. But it's definitely a technology that is worth noting and saying it is out there, and in some cases may be implementable with certain facilities. So that concludes my information I'm provided to this presentation. Thank you all. You can go to the next slide, please.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Davidson, Ms. Nunn, Ms. Knopf, and Mr. Rower. And do members have questions for this panel at this time? Okay, hearing none. Thanks, everyone, for presenting. You know, of course, some building owners have lots of resources. Other building, maybe other folks who occupy buildings or small businesses, and they're just trying to stay safe during the pandemic. So I really appreciate you sharing this information. I hope it is can help empower some small businesses to make informed choices about reducing risk in their operations. The second, as a kind of a second round today, we're going to have Keith Wrightson. He previously testified about policy with respect to state facilities, and I wanted to invite him back to provide some additional detail about reducing the risk of indoor transmission of COVID, which, of course, is applicable at private businesses as it is in public facilities. So Mr. Wrightson is going to offer some further testimony. A lot of it's consistent with what you just heard, but has some additional details on transmission of COVID, including through aerosolized particles. So, Mr. Wrightson, if you're online, please begin your presentation. If you can just ask to advance your slides at the appropriate time, we'll do that.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Keith Wrightson. Good afternoon. Co-chairs Fields, Christ Tompkins, and members of the House State Affairs Committee. I am a health and safety specialist with AFSCME. That's the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, located in our national office in Washington, D.C. On behalf of the 8,000 employees AFSCME represents in Alaska, I respectfully urge you all and those in businesses to incorporate a series of hazard prevention controls in indoor workplaces to reduce the risk of exposure to SARS-CoV-2. And for the purposes of today's presentation, I'll be referring to SARS-CoV-2 is a coronavirus, just because it comes off the tongue a little easier. In doing so, when thinking about incorporating these prevention controls, a special emphasis should be placed on workplace configurations, ventilation, enhanced cleaning practices, and personal protective equipment to protect the health and safety of workers indoors. Before we get rolling into the slides, I have a few more words, and I'll let you know when it's time to advance. The CDC recognizes three vehicles of coronavirus transmission: the small droplets from speaking or coughing, which can end up in the eyes, the mouth, or the nose of people standing nearby; contact with contaminated surfaces; and transmission from aerosols, which is the inhalation of invisible infectious particles exhaled by an infected person. With Without ventilation, aerosols remain suspended in the air and become increasingly dense the longer an infected person remains in an enclosed space. The risk of contagion is highest indoors, but can be reduced by applying all of the available measures to combat infection from aerosolized respiratory droplets. It was once believed that the large droplets we expel when we cough or sneeze were the main vehicle of transmission. However, we now know that shouting and singing indoors in poorly ventilated spaces over a prolonged period also increases the risk of exposure. This is because speaking in a loud voice releases 50 times more virus-laden particles than when we do not speak at all. So different levels of voice, the way you enunciate, raise your voice, lower your voice, it all affects how much virus potentially could be coming out if you were infected. These aerosols, if not diffused through ventilation, become increasingly concentrated, which increases the risk of infection. Scientists have shown that these particles, which we also release into the atmosphere when simply breathing, and which can escape from improperly worn face masks, can infect people who spend more than a few minutes within a 16-foot radius of an infected person, depending on the length of time and the nature of the interaction. So there are multiple factors that come into play. I'm going to jump into my slides here so you can advance. A lot of the things that I'm saying are very consistent with the individuals that spoke earlier, particularly the other gentleman from ASHRAE and the other folks. So you should be on number one, which is workplace configuration, or slide number two, pardon me. So worker safety and health is something that we really need to examine and get people involved with. A lot of workplaces typically don't give consideration to worker safety and health, and that's very discouraging for individuals such as myself. But prior to opening or, you know, during the process of a phased opening, et cetera, workers and employers should work together and perform a detailed review of the configuration of work spaces. They can act together to eliminate reception seating areas and require clients, visitors, and guests to phone ahead of a specific time to enter the workplace or the workspace. We don't want a lot of unnecessary folks congregating in our workplaces any longer until we get this thing under wraps. Employers, pardon me, can install plastic partitions, which you heard about earlier today, in reception spaces where one-on-one meetings are conducted to provide a barrier between the public and office staff. Workers and employers should work together to review floor plans and removing or reconfigurating seats, furniture, workstations, et cetera, to achieve physical distancing in accordance with guidelines, and that's generally 6 feet, those guidelines. Have been fairly consistent on the 6-foot rule. Other public health measures, however, have changed over the last 9 months. Reconfiguring workstations so employees do not face each other or installing partitions if facing each other, if that can't be avoided. So, you know, we can turn desks around and give people some space and This is going to require some thinking, but I'm confident if parties work together, they can overcome all of this. Streamlining building and office space entry and exit points is also something that should be considered in accordance, of course, with local building codes to limit and monitor clients, visitors, guests in the building and to ensure that the building capacity levels are not exceeded. So there's a lot with the that can happen in collaboration, workers and employers working together. I highly encourage it. Workers tend to have some of the best ideas, in my opinion, on how workplaces can function. Let's move on to the next and talk a little about meeting rooms. If in-person meetings are essential, employers should consider limiting the size of meetings in accordance with local, state, and federal guidelines. So generally, that's meetings of 5 to 10 people max. Those are guidelines that are nationally all over the place. You see some states going higher, some going lower. The truth of the matter is we can avoid in-person meetings altogether. We are far better off. In-person meetings should only take place in workspaces if physical distancing can be achieved. Meeting rooms that are used should be disinfected regularly and after each use. Disinfectant wipes or spray should be left in each conference room, and employees should be encouraged to wipe down all surfaces and equipment. That includes mouses, keyboards, phones, water coolers, etc., touched during conference room meetings. Lingering and socializing before and after meetings should be discouraged. And everybody's been in that situation at one point in their life. Big meeting breaks up. It's like, hey, hang around for a sec. You don't want to do that anymore. And employees should be encouraged to use virtual meeting tools, including phone and virtual teleconference lines in lieu of in-person meetings whenever possible. Let's move on to the next slide. Lobby and common areas. Lobby, security, check-in, delivery, receiving doors, receiving areas should be cleaned and disinfected at least daily, and that's the minimum there. I would also encourage a more heightened cleaning, and we'll talk a little bit more about cleaning here in a minute, in high-traffic areas, especially around lobby areas. Occupancy limits should be established for passenger and freight elevators. Generally, no more than 2 individuals in the elevator cab at once to achieve physical distancing, and that creates an immense challenge for buildings that are, high-rise buildings and whatnot. How are you going to move people up into the upper reaches of the other buildings and whatnot? So, with only being able to put 2 people in there at a time. Signage should be prominently displayed, encouraging staff and visitors to follow physical distancing measures at least 6 feet again. Practicing good personal and environmental hygiene. So we encourage signage for hand washing, respiratory etiquette, cleaning and whatnot. The reason we want to be visible is we're trying to change a culture. Signage is something that is easily done, in my opinion, printed and posted. We want to be in the face of people that are coming to our workspaces, coming to our buildings and whatnot, and serve as those signs will serve as a constant reminder. You could have signs also for respecting occupancy limits and discouraging of lingering and socializing in common areas around building entrances and exits, and or loading docks. On to the next slide, please. So break rooms, break room areas, again, should be cleaned and disinfected at least twice daily. A special emphasis on cleaning should take place after typical break times, typically the coffee and the lunch hours. And it would be important for employers to task workers with that on a nice, consistent schedule, so we can maintain the proper cleaning during those high traffic times. Conjugating in kitchen areas should be discouraged, and that's another challenge, right, for anybody that's ever worked in an office or office space. You know, folks tend to conjugate in break room areas. Kitchen equipment and essential utensils should also be cleaned on a routine basis, including coffee machines, refrigerator handles, dishwashers, microwaves, toasters, water and beverage faucets, and ice machines and handles. There is a lot of high-touch objects in break rooms, and employers and workers are going to have to think together about how to overcome this and getting everything disinfected the right way. All silverware, dinnerware, coffee pots should be cleaned in the dishwasher. Ice machines that require a handheld scoop should be disconnected and taken out of service. Sorry, we are going to take your ice away. You may not have wanted to have heard that, those ice scoops are not sanitary, to say the least. If you have a lot of different hands going back and forth, et cetera, we need to end that practice. If vending machines are available for employee use, disinfecting should be required after each use. We also encourage to eliminate public access to vending machines, because, you know, we don't think we can get a commitment from everyone to clean it out of after each use, and employees will be more likely to clean it after each use. Let's move on to the next slide, onto restrooms. Employers should be placing trash cans and disposable towels by the door. If the door cannot be opened without touching a handle, you heard about some engineered devices earlier today, and we support that. There's foot drags and different little gadgets that can be attached to doors, so you don't have to use your hands anymore. There's also automation, I realize that would be quite expensive, so there are, you know, manual things that we can do to avoid using the door. And in the event that's not possible, we do want to make sure the trash can and disposable towels are there by the door. Employers should place signs indicating that toilet lids, if present, should be closed before flushing. Coronavirus may be aerosolized when flushing the toilet, and that is something I want everybody to think about in your workspaces. Place signs asking employees and the public to wash their hands before and after using the restroom. Again, signs serve as a visibility, and we are trying to change a lot of people's minds on personal hygiene, so those signs do serve a purpose. Employers should clean and disinfect restrooms available for public use on an hourly basis. Vent where possible. Turn exhaust fans on if vented directly outdoors, and run a fan consistently. Any movement of air, as you heard before, is going to help the situation and move any suspended aerosolized droplets. Employers should keep bathroom windows closed if open windows could lead to re-entertainment of air into other parts of the building. if the exhausted air could re-enter the building through intakes or other openings. And lastly, employers should have an ample supply of hand soap and sanitizer available for use in the restroom. Let's move on to ventilation, temperature, and humidity. I'm not going to spend a lot of time here because my information comes from ASHRAE. It's a highly respected organization. So I think we are just going to move right over this slide and go on to cleaning chemicals. This is an area of particular concern for workers. The pandemic, the virus, is one thing. But exposure to the disinfectants that are now being handed out and issued in workplaces all across Alaska, all across the country, all across the world is of equal concern. The ingredients that are in a lot of these products that are found on EPA list and are also considered hazardous material by the Occupational Safety and Health Administration and also by the Department of Transportation. The majority of products out there qualified to kill coronavirus include hydrogen peroxide, sodium hypochlorite, perioxide acids, isopropanol, and sodium chlorite. These products that are listed here require special handling, and if they are being issued for employee use, employees must be trained under OSHA's Hazardous Communication Standard or the HAZCOM Standard. In layman's terms, they must be trained in chemical safety. There is some pretty dangerous things associated. If it was to splash in your eyes, if it was to be inhaled or ingested, and that training would inform workers what first aid measures that would need to be executed. The training would tell workers that a safety data sheet must be available for each product. And how to read that sheet. That training would tell workers what PPE, personal protective equipment, is required when using these products. It is very, very important. All of these products listed here are found on EPA, the ingredients are found on EPA List N, disinfectants for use against SARS-CoV-2, a.k.a. the coronavirus. Additionally, the DOT, the Department of Transportation, considers materials that contain these ingredients hazardous materials, and therefore individuals must be trained on the safe loading, unloading, handling, storing, and transporting of hazardous material and emergency preparedness for responding to an accident or incident involving the transportation of such. In other words, people that are handling these things are considered hazmat employees. And I know a lot of folks wouldn't think of it that way, but the products that are being issued out there are very dangerous, can cause significant health effects. They can be acute, they can set in on a long-term basis, a.k.a. chronic, right? So you may not find out that you're now sick for many, many years because you mishandled and misused a cleaning product. I encourage employers to work to come into compliance with OSHA's HAZCOM rule and the Department of DOT transportation rules on handling and shipping any of these products. Let's move on to the next slide on personal protective equipment. So personal protective equipment, or PPE, What's up there on the screen is a typical gear that would be issued to a healthcare worker who is working in a COVID-19 ward or an infectious disease ward. The virus would require them to wear face shields and goggles. It would also require an N95 or higher respirator. Healthcare workers would wear one pair of clean gloves. They'd wear an isolation gown. They'd perhaps also wear a protective bootie on their shoe cover. Not everybody needs to wear this. All right. If you're in a non-healthcare environment, you're not going to need to be decked out in all of this gear. So it all depends on the type of hazard that the worker is facing, and that speaks to the personal protective equipment that is required to be issued. Workers must wear PPE that will protect them against the coronavirus and other hazards associated with chemicals, which they may be exposed during cleaning and decontamination of surfaces and objects. Examples of PPE that may be needed while caring for COVID.
If I could jump in and ask a question, thinking about a non-healthcare context, but a place where maybe employees necessarily have to be around other people, to what extent do KN95 masks reduce their risk, provide a degree of protection for, say, an employee, and are there any other sort of commercially available products similar to KN95 masks that provide a degree of protection for the mask wearer greater than just a simple surgical mask?
So the issue with a KN95, let me just back up one sec. So a filtering face piece is the technical name that we use in occupational health and safety world. And a lot of folks out there in the world would say, oh, that's an N95. All of these types of respirators have different ratings that speak to their efficiency and what they're designed for. So the letter N in N95 means that respirator is not oil proof, and it will filter 95% of the contaminants in the air. You could also have an R95 or a P95, and the R stands for resistance to oil, and the P standing for oil proof. And those numbers can go up the scale. So out there commonly in the market for filtering face pieces, N95, N97, N99, and you can attach those numbers to any of the NPR letters, all the way up to a P100. Those style respirators are designed to seal to an individual's face to prevent contaminants from entering. The way that they're designed, the way that you have to wear them is of a particular way. The KN95 does not seal to the worker's face. The majority of them, the straps that you use to secure it are of a looped system that goes behind the worker's ears. The KN95, it's an alternative right now, and I would say acceptable in non-healthcare environments. But in healthcare environments, we really need the certification of NIOSH and whatnot.
And are there other, for non-healthcare environments, say someone working in a restaurant or a similar environment, are there other commercially available alternatives other than KN95 that provide a higher degree of protection compared to just a cloth or a surgical mask? Or is KN95 pretty much the only option available, since even N95s continue to be very hard to come by in Alaska.
That's accurate. So that would probably be the only thing that they could get. We're not going to ask people to wear elastomeric half masks or full face masks. That would just be very, very awkward, especially in that type of environment. So a KN95 is probably the best thing that's available out there.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure. So I'll just wrap up here on PPE. We've got a couple more things ahead of us. Examples of PPE for while caring for a patient or during cleaning and decontamination. Going to include nitrile gloves. We do not want latex gloves being available. A lot of people have latex allergies. They may not find out until they put the gloves on one day that they have a latex allergy. So we personally like nitrile. It's a form of a plastic, if you will. Goggles and face shields are absolutely going to be necessary. Fluid-resistant or fluid-impermeable gowns, overalls, coveralls, etc., dedicated work clothing and washable shoe covers are all required if you're working with COVID patients or you're doing a decontamination. Let's move on to the next slide, communications. For us, we think it's very, very important for workers and employers to collaborate and designate an effective means of communicating information on new workplace policies and changes prior to reopening and upon resuming operations. A communications policy that establishes formal and informal routes of communication for staff to express concerns, questions, comments, and feedback is a necessity. We see a lot of retaliation, and that is very unfortunate out there. We strongly encourage employers to develop communication policies that truly do have an open door for workers to speak of their concerns without retaliation for doing so. This is a very difficult moment, and we do want to make sure that the lines of communications are open between workers and employers. Let's move on to the next slide. Excuse me. Just two more here, and we'll be finishing up. Training is also very, very important for workers and also employers. Education and training opportunities provide employers, managers, supervisors, and workers with knowledge and skills needed to do their work safely and avoid exposure to coronavirus that could place themselves or others at risk. Awareness and understanding of policies and procedures and how to identify, report, and control exposure to coronavirus very important. Specialized training when their work involves unique hazards is also of the importance. I just want to make the committee aware that as soon as employees are issued a disinfectant, they must be trained under OSHA's hazard communication rule. As soon as an employee is issued an N95 respirator or something better, than a filtering face piece, employees must be trained and the employer must comply with the respiratory protection standards. And that applies to all personal protective equipment. If the employer is handing that out and making it a requirement to wear, then the employer must train folks on how to properly wear PPE, how to don it and doff it, store it, get rid of it, throw it away, et cetera, et cetera. If they don't, it creates a sense of false hope amongst workers. So you will say, oh, we've been issued all this gear. We must be all set. But the truth of the matter is personal protective equipment is the last line of defense, and there are lots of complications that go along with it. Well, to go on to the last slide. Flexible work policies. Employers should adopt flexible work policies that minimize exposure and transmission to the virus by reducing the number of workers in a workplace at the same time. Flexible work policies also consist of staggering work schedules that have workers in an office at different times during the day. So employers could be thinking about that, moving people around, splitting shifts. I know that's an inconvenience, but if it reduces or minimizes exposure to the virus, it makes sense to me. This also includes continuing the use of telework, either full-time or at regular intervals. Maybe every other day you could be on telework. That might help reduce occupancy in the workspace. Consideration should be given to changes in transportation options available to workers and CDC guidance encouraging the use of forms of transportation that minimize close contact with others. So there's plenty also to be said about policies and procedures that employers are going to introduce, and we recommend that they collaborate with workers when making workplace changes through policy. That's it for me. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak with you all today.
Thank you very much, Mr. Wrightson. And certainly, if other members have questions, let me know. First, I want to read a question that Representative Story had, I think primarily for the first panelist. So Representative Story asks, have you been asked by the state to assess state buildings, schools, public safety places, including prisons? She also asks, what sort of private businesses have asked for this kind of analysis regarding COVID safety? And Representative Story also asks, are you aware of best practices from peers in other states, including in other public buildings? And she says she appreciates you being with us today. So I don't know if Ms. Davidson, Nunn, Knopf, or Mr. Roer want to address any or all of those questions.
Certainly. This is Dana. Thank you for the question. It was a long one, so I don't know if I'm going to remember all of the parts of it. I have been working with some state agencies through COVID. I have a term contract, or my firm has a term contract with DOT and also with the Alaska Court System, amongst other organizations and entities. At the very outset, I was engaged with the court system in understanding occupancy loads for courtrooms and lobbies and jury call spaces so that they could establish a baseline and then apply local mandates for occupancy limitations that have changed over the last 9 months. And so that was looking at spaces that maybe we had designed and had records of, or maybe we hadn't, and we were conducting code analyses to establish those occupancy loads. And that was to help them understand what they could or couldn't do, how they could accommodate court proceedings, particularly jury trials. How do you bring in a jury all at one time, especially for jury call, especially in larger cities? It tends to be a pretty big jury call, or when I was working with them on the Kodiak Courthouse last year, I know that they don't invite the island, but they essentially invite the island to get a pool of jurors for a case. And so how do you do that safely? And in a lot of cases, they determined that at least for the time being, they couldn't. And along the way, they've made some different allowances for who all else might be permitted in a courtroom so that the jury could be distanced. And so I have not been part of the conversations of developing the plans for the court system, but I have been on call with the facilities folks at the court system as they've had questions dealing with specific facilities around the state. And we're currently working on some upgrades in Kotzebue, unrelated to COVID, but still considering COVID as we're helping advise on what those upgrades would be. We've worked with the DOT as well, so occasionally we'll get questions, though not recently, related to Pioneer Homes, for instance. We're working on projects right now for some of our correctional facilities with DOT. And so, again, not specifically related to COVID, but applying what we know in mitigating COVID to the parts of the projects that we're in and sharing information along the way that they can take and leverage however they see fit. School districts, I personally have not been involved in school districts recently, but our firm is very involved with school district work, particularly in Western Alaska, and so consistently advising them on best practices for implementing sanitization and disinfection protocols, especially since, as the second speaker mentioned, these chemicals are considered hazardous, and we're asking lay people to use them, so understanding what they do and how they do it, and how to use them safely is pretty critical, but also the investment in our facilities is really huge. It's very expensive to build in Alaska, so helping our school districts and other clients understand that material compatibility of building finishes and interior furnishings with our cleaning strategies so that you're not destroying what you've just installed. I do have a client that's not related to the state, but it is in Alaska. It's just not an agency. And we're replacing $1 million of furniture in a 40,000 square foot facility because of an incompatibility of materials and cleaning practices. And once a material has degraded, you cannot disinfect it. You've rendered it unable to be disinfected. And that became the biggest issue, is that now the materials were not compatible, they failed rapidly, and they could not actually provide a safe space after all. And so working with them to understand what went wrong in their existing stuff and to avoid that in the new furnishings was that project. And then with some of our private clients, some clients are, you know, in an existing building and have no major capital improvement funds to do major overhauls. So working with them and our engineers to identify some of those freestanding solutions like the in-room HEPA filter or the humidification, along with interior furnishings and spacings and cleaning protocols. But I do have clients that are poised at the right spot in design of a major overhaul, and we are implementing significant improvements to the proposed ventilation systems. We're introducing UVC. We're increasing those ventilation rates, and our engineers are designing systems that can accept variable filtration. So while we need heavier filtration during COVID, they can put that in there. But when the threat settles and we understand it better and we actually have reliable mass immunity, herd immunity, you know, which is still a ways down the line, then they can back the filtration down to a good, healthy level, but that's not overkill. So they can return to maybe higher performance and better energy use of those systems when COVID and the situation settles a little bit. I know I missed some of your questions, but I also talked a lot, so I hope that answers.
No, that was great. I think the only additional question, again, reading here from Rep Story, was how else are you able to make information like this available to the general public, say, you know, small business owners who maybe aren't PhD epidemiologists and don't have time to necessarily read all the emerging evidence about COVID transmission and how to reduce risk.
Perfect. So I would recommend that even if you're not into getting a certification and a plaque on the wall of your building, looking into that health and safety guideline that the International WELL Building Institute created that arose from that task force, because that really was a clearinghouse for evaluating the reliability of information coming out and then developing resources for organizations. So that's a good starting point. I'm sure Craig can speak to some of the resources that ASHRAE has available, and then I also know that ASID at the national level, American Society of Interior Designers, we had a task force in parallel with IWBI, and they have just finished their review of literature and came up with 68 approved resources out of well over 200 that were submitted for review, and so we're in the process actually of collating that into a usable resource for the general public, And so as soon as that website is live, I can certainly share that with you, Representative Fields, and you can distribute it. And part of that will be a few different briefs, one of which is geared more towards students or legislators and things like that, looking at kind of bigger picture items, and then some of the other briefs will be specific issue briefs on building types, applications, and really looking at that interface of design and immunology with real strategies that you can apply.
Great, thank you. Do other members have questions for our panelists? Okay, hearing none, I really appreciate everyone taking the time. You know, OSHA did not issue any kind of guidelines on COVID safety, so I know I've heard from business owners who are trying to do the right thing. I know I have business owners in downtown who have already taken some of these measures. Obviously, all businesses have different level of resources, so I appreciate you making this information available so that our entrepreneurs can make informed decisions and our public building managers can do that as well. In addition to the panelists, I want to thank Barbara Cash, Chair of the American Society of Interior Designers College of Fellows, who helped organize this. And in closing, thanks to the LIO and my staff for organizing this hearing. At 3:45, the House State Affairs Committee is adjourned.